This is Puanani Harvey, April 27, 1991, Dreaming the Myth Onward.
I kind of lose track of what's going on. I've got this. And when I'm working with myth, this is particularly true, that myth takes us into another space. And those of you who were present last night may have found that happening for you, as you saw some of those images and heard the story of Medusa, that it doesn't quite fit in our ordinary way of thinking and being. And that's what I'm hoping today, in the time that we're together, we'll be able to go into this other time and space in a safe way, see how it impacts us, and come out at 4 o'clock on the other side and have gained something for ourselves. That would be what I would hope for. If they have flowers. Now, there were two of you who weren't here last night, right? You were one and you were the other. Everyone else was here. So let me just say a little bit about this notion of the dreaded feminine, that what it is that I'm hoping to touch on. This is something that I hope goes beyond the negative or terrible mother. Want to touch on that aspect of the feminine, which carries a very deep religious dimension and carries the aspect of both fear and awe. And this is way back in the Holy of Holies. And I've gone over to the pagan Greek tradition and looked at three images, Metis, Medea, and Medusa, to help us experience some of what this might be about. And last night we touched briefly on Metis. She was the first wife of Zeus, and she disappears. She gets swallowed up. And she comes out, her daughter comes out as Athena, out of Zeus's head. The second that I talked about very, very briefly, and I spent a little time with her this morning, is Medea. And some of you may know some about her through Euripides. And then the third was Medusa. Now, she is the most ancient, just about the most ancient myth that we know of. And we'll review a few of the images of her today, how she goes back to masks. And if we had time today, we probably would make some masks even. That would be the ideal. If we had 2 days together, we would spend part of today and tomorrow morning making masks. And that would bring some of these images even more to life. But we don't have that amount of time. So, because we're this size group, it would help me if I just quickly knew what brought you here this morning. We just went around, and if you would just tell your first name and just what your hope for today is. Are you agreeable with that, just to kind of come together? You want to begin? Okay. Michael?
What brought you here is
more information about myths or... Uh-huh, okay. Archetypal? Okay, good. Okay. Okay. Good.
Michael, where's
it? That point about being in transition and wanting to know more and how myth can be important in that. And myth can be because in it there is so much energy that is expressed in myth. And when we are in transition, it's not unusual for what feel like key parts of ourselves to get freed up, parts that we don't yet know about. And they feel crazy to us because they're coming out of places we don't know, and they make demands on us that are new and different. And so we label them as crazy. And it really, we will recognize motifs in myths that help us to make sense of that space. And as I said last night, you know, Freud was able to make quite a psychology out of the Oedipus myth. And it explained to us many, many triangular situations and the kind of energy that's in them. Okay, go on, Michael. Good. Okay, good, Judith. Society, when it's going through so many of the changes that we seem to be going through now, even those, that doesn't contain us well. Some people like to see that we're in a borderline time. You know, that if you know in psychiatric labeling, you will hear this classification called borderline. Used to be narcissistic personality disorder was vogue. And we were all experiencing our narcissistic wounds. Now we're all moving to the borderline. But I think it's timely, and I think it goes with what's happening culturally. As we approach the year 2000, all of the shifting that's going on, walls that divide are coming down, other walls go up. Everything seems to shift so fast. It's a borderline time. Containers aren't here. It's scary. Craziness breaks out. We certainly saw it in the Middle East as to what broke out, and we try using old ways to respond to something. And obviously those are more destructive than we can tolerate. So I like to think that what we're about is learning within ourselves. This was a point of Jung, that when we see outwardly so many problems, the thing to do is to go within and to come to terms with what that problem looks like on the inner planes. So our own Middle East war is where we are. Our own discovering what are the conflicts within. What are the ways of trying to meet these? And so what you said about being scared ourselves is really, it's true, it's scary to us when there's no containers for this energy. It's really true. Kelly, do you want to say anything, Kelly, back there? Onward. And that's a term, or that's a phrase, that comes from Jung, who felt that the challenge was to take myth and take it in present time and dare to dream it forward. So it isn't as if we go back, study Medea, Medusa, Metis, and stay in that frame. The real challenge is, what does it mean to us now in this present time? What are these images that come out? And while we're together today, there'll be art materials that are here. And what I'd like you to do is, just as you feel inclined, so inclined, just let yourself sit here listening to me, draw, shape, whatever you want to do. Because it's letting something come through us. There's no right, there's no wrong, we're not really goal-directed, but we're just trying to see, how does this take us? Where does it take us? And are we open to maybe some new forms that can emerge? Thanks, God. Yeah, your turn. About, as I hear Kate talking about meeting a situation in the outer world which took her to places in herself that were very new and painful, foreign, alien. Right. Right, and the myth of Medusa would really help in that when we talk some, because Medusa lives on the edge of the alien. And we all will find ourselves up on situations that are so foreign to us, so chilling, so awesome and terrifying. Yeah.
How could I get over here? But it's very afraid of the cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. And knowing that there's a space between where there are no images for a while. There's nothing. And that's what's so terrifying in this, is that all of a sudden something happens and it makes no sense. It's so alien, so foreign, that you don't know what to do with it. And when we talked about early damage, early wounds, we'll often see that there are spaces where there is no imagination and no images whatsoever. And that leaves a person very cast off, cast out, alone, alien, terrified. We'll touch on that a little bit more later. Going on. Oh, alien. Good. So really new and just kind of coming in just to see what it's about? Mm-hmm. Good. Good, Richard. Good. A good family. It's so, you know, this is one that so much focus right now is on, well, like Bradshaw's doing, where he's really getting us sensitive to the dysfunctional family and what that looks like. But it can be as difficult to have the good, good, good family. Because what is there to go off and push against? What is there that is giving us that restlessness within, that pain within, that prods us and nags at us? So it's got its own journey as to when it's so good, how do I individuate out of that? Well, that's where I see that some of these myths are very important for particularly good, nice people. I mean, you'll notice that I'm talking about some of the uglier myths. These are not the beautiful. We're not sitting here talking about the finer aspects of Aphrodite. We're talking about, you know, there's a lot of blood and gore and ugliness and beheading and all of this. And I think it's very much a companion to even a Christian ethic of being good and the light. A lot of our current new age of being in the light. These darker aspects of the feminine complement them in a very rich and dynamic way. They contain a lot of blood energy. And if we have time today, I want to come back to this motif of blood energy, because it's in the Medusa for sure, and you're going to hear about it in the Medea as well. And again, if we have time, we'll go back and look at a couple of those Medusa images and talk about it, linked to blood energy. Okay, let's kind of go forward. Well, we'll start dreaming the myth onward a little bit this morning. I want to share with you the Medea myth. I don't have slides of her. She's not an image that the Greeks put on their temples or put on as much of their funerary urns. There are a few. And back in about 84, when I got very taken with her, I went over to the Louvre in Paris and was stunned to see one image of her on this old urn, and there she was, shown with her blade, about to kill her children. And that's pretty much the memory we keep of her, of the killing mother. And that's a very forbidden aspect of motherhood, for sure. And those of you who've had good mothers probably don't even know that a mother could ever have such a killing impulse. But a lot of us who've been mothers know that there have been times when we have wished for space for ourselves, and that feels forbidden, that feels like we're not being the good mother, that we're not being there the way we should be. So just with some of these aspects in mind, we'll listen to Medea. You know what I think might be best while we're listening to her is for you to just be as comfortable as you can be. If you want to take a break, let's take a couple of minutes break. Get coffee if you want some coffee or tea. I could say for everything that was said in this room is part of me also. And probably the dreaded feminine comes a lot in my own journey with who I am as a woman. I spent a good number of years in the Bay Area raising my daughters, and as Kate said last night, started a school for 9 to 14-year-olds. At the same time, I was in graduate school and studying psychology. But I was most interested in social psychology at the time. I was very, very concerned with social change and social action. And I didn't really believe in one-to-one therapy. And I went back to graduate school in the early 70s, and there was a time in Berkeley when there was a great deal of opposition to classical psychology, and particularly depth psychology. Freud was an anathema. And there was a lot of criticism of that kind of therapy that was many times a week at high cost, and it was seen as a social blight. You know, what was happening? So I was schooled somewhat in that tradition. Fritz Perls was down at Esalen, stirring everybody up. It was a hubbub of activity in Berkeley. So not only was I studying psychology at UC Berkeley, I was also creating a school for kids. It was an alternative school where how could young people at this pubertal interface, how could they stay in schools in a way that they stayed intact as whole people? Berkeley at that time was a dynamic place for experimentation. And it wasn't just experimentation in kind of a libertine, laissez-faire way. It was really trying to be very conscientious about it. And I had two daughters that were invested in this, too. So I was concerned, what is it that we're doing? Now, meanwhile, as all of this is happening, I myself am being taken to places in myself I never planned to go. Roles were falling away. Things weren't working. I saw no mirrors back that told me what was happening to me. And I went into different kinds of therapies trying to understand what is it in me that is always breaking through, always breaking through. I was very involved in religion at the time, considered going to seminary, thought that that was going to be my path, went on many, many pilgrimages. In some ways you could say was a seeker. Maybe I'm still a seeker. But I find that now what I'm seeking is the depths of the psyche, perhaps. I think it's all ultimately one. The dreaded feminine came real close to me because of who I am as woman. There was a resonance. It was a resonance that kept saying, there's something here for me. And my own, as I call them, crazy parts, made more sense to me. When I read the Medea many, many, many years ago, when I saw Dame Judith Anderson do Medea, I thought, why am I having this deep response to her? I am a good, loving wife and mother. And yet, there is something about this woman that wants to kill her rival, wants to kill the children that come as a result of her union with Jason. I couldn't understand this place way down in here that was stirred. I'm still efforting to understand that deep, deep stirring that comes way down in the depth of our being. Medea means a lot to me. I now understand what she means for me a lot more. She led me to Medusa, and that was a harder one for me to come to terms with, Medusa, because that is real archetypal dangerous energy over there, because it's so, it eliminates all images, and that's really scary for me. It was for me. I'm wandering around as to why I'm doing this, because I'm still wandering around doing it. And I'd say that what I'm trying to do now is to integrate the psychological and the spiritual. And I see that they interface somewhere here with the dreaded feminine. And as I'm working with, I mentioned last night, the Women's Spiritual Center, we've been looking at just what does this interface look like. I want to go to Medea now. Okay. I'm just going to read a little bit to you. Thanks. This is the Medea. And now, who was she? In the Medea, Euripides plunges his 5th century BC audience into the maelstrom of betrayed marital love. The grieving Medea calls upon the gods to witness what sort of return Jason has made to her love. And here I'm quoting Euripides. She lies without food and gives herself up to suffering, wasting away every moment of the day in tears. So it has gone since she knew herself slighted by him. But who is this disconsolate woman turned inward upon her pain? This is the Medea, legendary for her powers which enabled the Greek Jason to accomplish his heroic retrieval of the Golden Fleece from her father's land. As the drama unfolds, Medea will remind Jason, I saved your life, and every Greek knows I saved it. Every Greek who was a shipmate of yours aboard the Argo, when you were sent to control the bulls that breathed fire and yoke them, and you would sow that deadly field, also that snake who encircled with his many folds the Golden Fleece and guarded it and never slept, I killed and so gave you the safety of the light. And I myself betrayed my father and my home, and came with you to Peleus' land of Iolcus. And then, showing more willingness to help than wisdom, I killed him, Peleus, with a most dreadful death at his own daughter's hands, and I took away your fear. So this is Medea reminding Jason all that she's done for him. It was she who provided Jason with the magic potion which would protect him from the bull's fiery breath. It was she who instructed Jason to cast the stone among the advancing dragon-teeth men. And again, it was Medea who drugged the snake protecting the Golden Fleece of the sacrificed ram. You'll get a sense of her powers and her abilities. For each of the hero's tasks, this is the woman of knowing who protects with the feminine arts of herbs and potions, magic spells, and secret instructions, thereby enabling Jason to become one of the early Greek heroes. This is the Medea of the magic cauldron, that vessel of the feminine, which she used first to illustrate her powers to rejuvenate and later to destroy. Now, this is that motif of container, the cauldron. Last night we saw a container called a head. The head is like a container of consciousness, of awareness. And in our emphasis on enlightenment and the light, we've focused on the head and at times eliminated a lower cauldron, the cauldron, if you will, of the lower body. You will see in some of the Greek sculptures, early sculptures, in the feminine, the lower full hips, almost as if the lower part of the body itself is a container, itself is a vessel, itself is a cauldron. A blood cauldron, if you will. To rid Jason of his dreaded rival, Peleus, he who was going to be a contender for Jason's right to the kingdom, Medea comes up with this diabolical scheme. She says to, she pulls out her cauldron and she shows that if she puts in an old ram, casts her spell over the cauldron, out comes a young kid. So in other words, she's able to restore to youth. So Peleus, the contender for the throne, he's an old man and he wants to be young again. And she says, "Aha, okay. Why don't you climb into my cauldron?" And she gets his daughters to help. Rather gory story. They put in their father into Medea's cauldron, and she does her spell. Only this time, she doesn't restore him to youth. She kills him. The point being that in her cauldron, she carries both the power for creation, restoration, renewal, redemption, as well as death, destruction. And this is a very important aspect of the deep feminine, that these opposites come together into one space. And therein is their danger, their dread, what we fear, and yet what also carries some of our fascination and our awe. Jung calls this the miracle of Medea. He doesn't go on to explore a great deal. This is in his very first work that he writes. If you ever get a chance to look at all of the collected works, this is volume 5. That is the volume that marks his break from Freud, The Symbols of the Unconscious. He was taken with the very depths of the unconscious at that time and said there's more to it than just sexual symbolism, sexual energy. Remember, he was starting to say to Freud, there are spiritual stirrings in the psyche. There is a spiritual instinct in the psyche. There is a religious instinct in the psyche. And he's looking at these early myths with that in mind. Now, this is the Medea, her heart on fire with passionate love, says Euripides, who abandons her father and her homeland. Oh, my father, oh, my country, in what dishonor I left you, killing my own brother for it. This is Medea, the woman from the edge of the patriarchal world, the distant Asian land, inflamed with love for the heroic man from the land of rational culture. The price of this love is a complete uprooting of her being. She is called to leave all that gives her history and identity. Colchis, her homeland, lies on the eastern shore of the Black Sea. To the Greek perspective, this is a land barbaric, alien, and irrational. The sun rises over Colchis. It is over Greece that it reaches its zenith. Greece, where the rational logos has ascended. So you can hear, if you've been listening to this, you think both within ourselves as individuals and also collectively what has happened. This describes a process that we all seem to go through, that there comes a time where we separate from the personal mother, from the very depths of our being, where it's all one. As early children, we are allowed to be in the irrational. And part of ego consciousness is separating out of that realm and coming up into greater and greater ego awareness, more of what starts to make sense, more of sometimes what we call the rational. But we pay a price for this. We separate out from part of our being. It is through dreams, it is through what you now are doing, of letting ourselves draw and paint and write, move, dance, that we try to stay connected to that world over there on the edge, that world of the rising sun. This is the Medea of personal sacrifice, who in casting from the stern of the fleeing Argo the dismembered body of her brother, cuts herself off from her blood ties and allegiances. She scatters her heritage into the depths of the sea, cruelly severing her blood ties and casting her lot with the patriarchal Greek heroic world. Paul, you were talking about meeting these 30 women, you know, these women that come at you with all of this stirring in them. And I think the Medea is a story for a lot of women who have, as young women, cast their lot perhaps with a man, married, started families, and merged their identity with the male world. And two of you this morning talked about the animus. And these women often will find themselves having something called the animus becoming very, very almost part of their identity. Who is this that seems to so possess and rule me? In my own work with women, I've discovered that actually the issue is not so much the animus, but what lies behind the animus. That the animus indicates that we have severed our connection to the deep feminine. And that's partly our issue with him, is what are we going to do with him? And now, I think we as Jungians have not helped women on this regard. I think we have placed the animus into women very much as it's if you want to think psychologically, it's like the way the culture gets interjected, the way the culture comes inside of us. If we feel comfortable saying it's been a patriarchal time for many thousands of years now, and a lot of us feel more comfortable with that, we don't have to fight that anymore. that our Father God represents that for us, for all of us, for men and for women. And we've all are coming to a time where maybe we want to dream the myth a little bit further on. We take that introject in. That introject lives inside as the animus for a lot of us. How that culture lives inside of us. Now there comes a point when we have to get around that and say, what are the other possibilities? And there are those who are very opposed to the Jungian perspective because of the animus theory, saying it's further oppressing women by saying you are animus identified or animus possessed. We won't get into that today, but I just acknowledge their work because I think it's important criticism. And there are some, like, you might have Verena Cast come one day and speak, and you'll hear her viewpoint is that we all, men and women, have an animus. Men and women, we all have an anima. And there's a lot of room for us to dialogue that way. Jung, if you remember, I mean, Jung in his time was describing things that he was discovering over there in Zurich that seemed to be linked to all cultures, but he also was a man of his time. Now I want to go on to the motif of what happens to Medea. She's left behind now. Last night I touched on this part of the myth. If you remember, Jason's come. He wants the golden fleece. There is the daughter of the king who knows how to get it for him. And she does everything she can. She really has fallen in love with this great hero. And she goes back with him to his land. And we pick her up now, 10 years later. After 10 years of marriage to Medea, Jason has decided to choose a new bride. As I said last night, he's in his midlife crisis. And it is the daughter of the king of Corinth. Euripides chooses to leave the princess bride unnamed, indicating her lack of character and identity, in sharp contrast to the powerful presence of Medea. So Euripides back in the 5th century BC is on to something already as to the power of the Medea, of what she represents. Jason says, on my wedding with the princess, here I will prove that first, it was a clever move. Secondly, a wise one. And finally, that I made it in your best interest and that of the children's. This was the main reason, that we might live well and not be short of anything. In his choice of a new bride, Jason speaks not of the heart and love, but of expedience, political advantage, and financial security. His is the Greek world of law, reason, heroic journeys from the dark, dangerous, chthonic realm. Jason chooses order, permanence, stability, security. An old wife has been replaced for practical, materialistic reasons, with no regard for this decision's effect in the relational sphere. Medea cries out, ah, lost in my sufferings, I wish I might die. When Medea recounts her investment in his heroic tasks, Jason depersonalizes and depreciates her by attributing everything to Aphrodite. For him, Aphrodite made him do it, not out of love for Medea. He says, my view is that Aphrodite alone was responsible for men and for gods for the preserving of my life. He adds, you have certainly got me more than you gave. No, excuse me. You have certainly got from me more than you gave. First, Instead of living among those barbarians, you inhabit a Greek island and understand our ways. You understand how to live with the law instead of the sweet will of force. Jason fails to understand Medea's reality or empathize with her role as wife and mother and her consequent suffering. Medea says, "I am deserted, a refugee, thought nothing of by my husband, something he won in a foreign land. I have no mother or brother, nor any relation with whom I can take refuge in this sea of woe." For a moment, can you get a sense of what the Medea is experiencing at this time? Are there any questions as to what's happening with her or for her right now? And we'll go on. Hers has not been a cool, partial, conditional love. She has given of her totality, and therein lies her vulnerability. With Jason's betrayal of his wedding vows, Medea is betrayed and deserted and thrust into an emotional exile. All that she has created, believed in, dedicated herself to, has fallen away.
Maybe when I was looking, I heard that she was, Medea was being abandoned for ordinance divinity and for standing up and talking about ridiculous and a lot, obvious lot. But when he abandoned such a, what we are going towards is the ordinance divinity of Caesar. Now, can you say what we have come, what we abandoned? We abandoned the God and her calling and power and her life-giving mystery and that saying, what is feeling that? What
else? If you were to think about this as a personal journey out from the unconscious, when you think back in the beginning, for those of you in counseling and psychology will know that in the last 20 years, we've had a tremendous increase in interest in early childhood. And people like Margaret Mahler, who start to delineate those early stages, how we start with this sense of oneness that we are identified with the mother. The mother and I are one. You could say it is as if we ourselves are in that cauldron where all the opposites come together. Everything that last night Neumann used that word, the uroboric mother. That place where everything is contained within itself. The world of the archetypes. The world of the self. Gradually, in development, all those little stages of separating out from the mother are critical ways the ego starts to be built up. How, in a way, we go to the Greek land of consciousness. We get this little bit of sense of how the world works. We start to try to make it predictable, to understand its laws, to understand its order, to understand its rules. We're also moving into the patriarchal sense of what law and order and rules are about. But that's what that little ego is doing. And then it goes back to the mother, and it fuses with her and merges with her, and then it goes out again. Now, people like Melanie Klein, those of you who know the work of Melanie Klein, who was an early post-Freudian. Are most of you familiar with Melanie? Do you know the name Melanie Klein? Those of you who don't, just raise your hands, have a sense of... Melanie Klein was a very interesting Freudian who got taken with children. She got seen through her work with adults that people were regressing to very early, early states. And that they were finding that they possessed in those early infantile stages things like affects like hate and rage and greed and things that we don't attribute the infant to the infant. You know, we project onto the infant innocence, purity, beginning out of the good. Melanie Klein dared to say that the infant carries within it the potential for destructive kinds of feelings, wanting to destroy the mother, wanting to hate the mother. Now, that's, you know, that's controversial. That's in how you see it. How is the object outside the self perceived? First, it's perceived in what they call a part object, the breast of the mother. They don't talk about the bottle, but they talk about the breast of the mother. But anyway, this is linked with those kinds of looking at early states. What's relevant for us in our own journey, as we go back to our beginnings, we often will discover that there are in the shadow, in the unconscious, forbidden impulses. It may come out even toward the good and perfect mother. And this is a very difficult thing to understand. How could I have these darker feelings? They may not come out toward the personal mother. It may come out toward your lover. That may be where you're first seeing. It may come out toward the sales clerk in the market. Very good point. Worse yet, it may come out toward yourself. And that's very often where you see it. And it's the skill of the therapist to help you pull that off yourself. Because in some ways, that's what keeps us down in the cauldron in its worst way, where we can't, are torn between the creative and the destructive aspects and can't get any good out of it. And when we're in there, in that maelstrom of all those feelings and all those forbidden impulses and energies, we need some help to differentiate them, pull them apart, take a look, and attribute them to other places than to the self. Making sense? Depression, certain kinds of depression particularly carry this, where the person gets locked down in there, can't get out, and there is this hateful, hateful attack on the self. I am totally worthless. I'm not worth being here. Some people can get very dangerous to themselves and in one of those mad moments act out a destructive impulse. It's a very powerful state. As you hear these dreaded feminine images, you can imagine that if you are down there in them and you don't have any sense of myth or any sense of images or names, you could just swirl around in that. Yeah. Say that again, Kate. Connection to... Yeah. There is no connection. There's no container. There's no connection. There's no relatedness. And relatedness becomes essential in this space. And very often when we're in the depths of it, you'll notice, those of you who've gone there, how you wish for someone to reach through to you, to somehow be there for you and understand or say something, do something, maybe just be there, just so that there's some sense of container, but also relatedness. The very missing is, and you'll hear this with Medea. I mean, what's happening, she's getting terribly unrelated. She's cut off ties with the only world, in the world that she's come from. She's lost connection with her beginning. As I said last night, she had a very poor connection to her mother, mythically. We know very little about her, except in Euripides we're given a name that etymologically means she who knows. But Medea's cast off from that woman, and she becomes identified just as the father's daughter, the king's daughter. And then in her journey to the Greek world, she severs her connections to her father, and she kills her brother. She chews him up into little pieces and casts him off the back of the boat so that the father will get distracted and rescue the son, his son, so she can help Jason to get away. I mean, she's severing all ties to her beginnings. Yes, Kelly.
Medea was connected with the goddess Hecate, who is goddess of the nest, the dread of the nest. I wonder, when she was removed from culture, was she also lost in her duty to the mother and her husband to the worship of the moon goddess Hecate, who is also like Hermes' character at the cornerstone of
Crossroads, yep. Great, and like last night, when you quickly move to redemption with the Pegasus, you are anticipating exactly where we're going. That's great. You can feel the move. That's exactly where it's got to come.
Noting as you were taking us through the myth that, yes, I've had, you know, also the necessity to go through the order and the stability, which a lot of the times identified with the unlocked, that something of the ritual dance and worship of the goddess for her mystery and her divine and creative process has been undertaken and is no longer the dance that I did, which I think I'm bad for.
Good.
And then the status of having no longer dancing to them, for all of the colleagues to be in the community and the system. That's wanting to build up to be a traditional in that region and that status. But I'm not forgotten, or I am no longer in the relationship.
Right, right. Kelly raises some good points about grief and sadness. You'll notice in the story of Medea, we're going to talk more about rage. And those of you who have encountered rage, particularly feminine rage, it is an awesome, terrifying experience, whether it comes at us or from within us. Often behind that rage, way back behind that, is a profound and desperate grief. And I don't think it's an accident that the Lamentations used to be feminine. And on tombs, ancient tombs, you would see the Lamentations in weeping, that they were on that threshold of the death realm. And we in our time have forgotten that, of the importance of lamenting and grieving and allowing the shedding of tears. You didn't hear anything having to do with tears with Medusa. and you don't hear them with the Medea. And yet that's way back there. There's the grieving of what's been lost. And before Medea leaves Colchis, she does have a night of prayer. We'll hear a little more about it as you hear the goddesses that she draws on. Draws on. Now, they go with her, but we don't yet know what that's going to look like. Any other questions right now? Thanks, Kelly. That was a good point. Any other questions?
You hear it on somebody else, so it says on your multi-generations.
You should. Very much so. So that that person, in their own... Right, because of what has been cast over into them. Is that what you're... Right? That originally, this person trying to get rid of this thing, as you said, their shame-basedness, passes it on to the next. Right. What, within a family particularly. And there's a model... Yes. It really depends how it's been done. And it reminds me of something Jung suggests. He says in a letter, complexes start 100 years before. Now, we don't have to get attached to the number 100. But what he's suggesting is they go on from generation to generation. So, the mother, the father, the whatever, passes it on. But does she get rid of it? I want to show you a drawing of something, or a sketch of something. Kate will identify this. This is an important concept of what the relationship between two people looks like. Here's number one. This is the first person, and this is the second person. And they're in relationship. Jill, you and I are in relationship. Here we are, thinking we're being conscious. Jill's sitting over there, and she's in relationship to her unconscious. Pooh's over here. I'm in relationship to my unconscious, hopefully. Now, Jill and I, our unconsciouses are in relationship to each other. We don't even know what they're doing. But if one of us, now I might be able to pick up that Jill is sending me a message from her unconscious and I can get it up here. Likewise, I might do it that way. I might be doing something this way. So do you get how rich an interaction becomes if you make room for the unconscious that's going on? Now, like you and I are all here, underneath us is an unconscious foundation. And we're all down there. These energies are working away on us. Now, there's an archetypal level way down there that supports us all. And we pray is with us and friendly to us and benign, and that we're not invoking a lot of angry goddesses down there. But we stand on that. But then we're all efforting to be as conscious with each other, also knowing that we're touching each other's unconscious. Now, this model goes on in a family big time, real big time, and particularly down here. And this one, the more conscious the parents are, the more work they do no matter what point in their life, the more they're able to set their children free because of the pool of the unconscious down here. It never gets cleaned out. I really don't think it ever gets cleaned out. But we're trying to, we talked about the Bradshaw work last night, and where he's doing a lot around this toxic shame and shame-basedness and the 12-step movement and all that that's going on, is efforting to make more conscious some of this realm that we call shame. All those feelings that have been shamed in us, never allowed to exist. They were to be kept down. You're to be good. Don't cry. Don't be angry. Don't talk back. Be respectful. Way down under stays a lot of shame-based natural affects that stir around, and they get almost too much importance because they were never allowed to just be naturally expressed. We talked about last night the children, how they make those funny Medusa faces at us. You know, how they stick out their tongue. And have you ever seen a child do that at you where they really try out to scare you in a way? And I don't know about you, but I've always had a response to that. You know, it's that you can feel that they really are trying to assert some power over this monolithic adult world that's out there. And it is scary. But anyway, Paul, I don't know if that answers that for you. But this is a very, very helpful model. And it's very helpful in... those of you who are in therapy, to be mindful of this model too, to know that God willing, Goddess is willing, the therapist sitting there has done as much work as he or she can possibly have done and continue to do to stay as present to her consciousness, his consciousness, and all that's stirring underneath, and to understand the symbols that you're giving. There is, those of you who have been drawn to Jungian work, Jung dared to say that the therapist or the analyst steps into that container with the client. Hopefully, the therapist keeps one foot out. But there are times that all of us in our work suddenly discover both feet are in the cauldron with the client. Because the material is so powerful, it's hooked us. Now, we've learned ways. We have little secret ladders of how to get out of that cauldron, we hope. But there are times when that archetypal energy is so powerful, it grabs onto us both. You will hear stories of Jung in his own work. Now that there's some people, we have a conference coming up this summer sponsored by the self-psychologists. And they're talking about the outrage of Jung and Sabina Spielrein. And there is no doubt about it that Jung, in his early work with some women, Sabina Spielrein being one, encountered the power of these archetypal, dreaded feminine dimensions. And he got pulled in for a while. Now, that is not to condone or pardon, because I know that we are, in our own ethics, trying to look at how do we make the therapeutic container a non-abusive one. And it's been a shame of the profession that there's been the acting out that there has been, of where there are... it happens most with a male therapist and a female client, but that doesn't say it doesn't happen in the reverse. But where the therapist gets pulled in and acts out the impulse toward an incestuous union. It's a powerful energy that works when you're in the container with those archetypal energies. I like to think that some of these issues that we currently are hearing so much about, particularly sexual abuse and incest. We're talking about powerful energies that we haven't had ways of dealing with, and they've been acted out in the container of the families. And as we work more mythically and we see what these energies can look like and what they can do, we might gain other more symbolic ways of handling these energies so they don't have to be acted out. Make sense? Yeah. That's a very important question, because that's ultimately what we have to ask ourselves. That as we look at these myths, it isn't enough just to stir up those images. We have to figure out now, how do I live with them? And I see a lot of these groups that are forming, where they gather together and where they do like we're doing, where we let ourselves make images and make pictures, where we drum and dance, where we chant. Some of you may know Sufi dancing. Have you ever heard about Sufi? Yeah. Sufi dancing? I think it's a very interesting form for transmuting of energy, of letting that energy build up to a certain point and then come to back to a place of quiet. Tai Chi is certainly a working with human energy. But it's that of all these ways that we're now trying to work with energy itself. There is a little book out that some of you may know. It's called A Circle of Stones. It's a lovely, lovely little book. Really? You know, that woman who, I don't know her, but she, pardon? Her name is Judith Dirk, D-U-E-R-C-K. I don't know if we have it out here on the... Do we? Great. It's written in this mode that we might call the feminine. So far we haven't defined that, thank goodness. But it's written in this mode, and she laments that there hasn't been a safe, containing circle within which we could reclaim these raw energies. And I think, see, you're describing how horrible it is to be alone with it. And I don't think that's the answer. I don't think that's the answer. That energy is as volatile. When we talk about atomic energy, this is similar to, for me, to that kind of nuclear energy that we are discovering, that we know so much about now on the outside. That this has that potential for creation and destruction just likewise. And we have to figure out what do we do with it. And I don't think we are called upon to be alone with it. Yeah.
What I was getting out of it and I stopped doing it and I still wanted to get back into it now, and now it's just a laziness that doesn't want. I wanted to bring that out of it because I saw that energy inside of me that terrified me. And the other thing that I want to do is kind of flip over into something else altogether. Well, it's connected, but there was recently some men went off raising children, cut up kids, some of my churches, the last couple of months or so, whatever, 6 months or so, something like that. And I've been working with the collective idea, collective unconscious. I've had dreams of building with people and just calling off these buildings and so forth. And I know that it's not safe to go over, but that is what I was explaining, and what I'm trying to understand some ways is that when I see there is Gandhi or, you know, someone who is on that level, or Muslim or something, there I go. And when I see this Hitler, murderer, racist, killer, there I am too. And that it isn't we take them and kill them and get rid of them as a simple solution, but it's understanding that I'm that person.
Right, right.
My dark side is capable of exactly the same thing and is terrified. I mean, it's nice to say, yeah, hey, Gandhi, I could be like Gandhi, I could be like Mother Teresa, I could be like one of these saints walking on water, On the other hand, there's a more evil person that we can defend, and I can be that person.
Yeah.
And this is the wish that I'm...
Mm-hmm. Well, Michael, two things. The first part about the Kundalini Yoga, those of you who will find that at different stages you try on something, like the Kundalini Yoga, and then you come to a point where you say, hey, wait a minute, I got to take time out of this. This is just stirring up too much. There's too much breaking through, if you will. I've got to pull back. That's a very important sensitivity to your own psyche. As the ego has to, is very essential for this kind of work. We've got to have, the ego becomes a container itself. And the ego is going to take in certain energies, and if it's energy that the ego can't handle, we need to back off a little bit, wash the dishes, clean out the cupboards, and walk the dog, work in the garden, go to work, balance your checkbook, you know, stay connected to the real world, so-called real world, and be sensitive to that. Don't let too much energy blast through you. Like those who've done a lot of drug work, or different kind of substances, mind-altering substances, journeying work with these medicines, certainly you go into very advanced places. But how much can the ego benefit from that? So it's this dialogue with the ego as the container.
Even what strikes me about it is even in the best of all possible personal world, I mean, if you're sensitive, if you're in a relationship with a man, it seems to me you still come to that point where, because around you in the culture there's an resonance that you have to stop, because at least for some of us, there's no place to enact what you ask it. And I think that when you're talking about enacting, you're supposed to consider your thinking about or feeling internally, understanding it all, that's great, but I think the same is great.
What are you going to do with it?
If you understand it and you feel it, it becomes more powerful because you sensitize to it. And your relationship with the man with the therapist is not a place where you can enact. It has to be the sort of strong test to make you kind of recognize sacred for ground that involves a deeper place. My experience for it, and that's the wall to anybody. If you go beyond that, one of us want to go back and delve into ancient mythology, but it seems to me that you can't do that. I'm not agreeing. I don't do that.
That's right. Right.
You can't be it for that. Mm-hmm. How is the ancient? Is there a way to have the expression of the process?
That's where we're essential to what it's up to us. What are we going to do with it? That's dreaming the myth only. Yeah.
Where is it? Where
there's, right.
Where I thought of going to an ashram for about 30 days and get spaced out, you know, and being able to sit in the corner and cry and go to whatever I want. Not only be safe, but there'll be people around the table. So it's not crazy.
Yeah, to hold that, yeah. Right. There was something, some of you may know, something called the Spiritual Emergence Network. It was founded by Christina Groff, Stanislaus Groff and Christine Groff. And it was speaking to this, saying that people go through crises, if you will, in consciousness. And when that hits, it can often make us feel, the word we're using is crazy. We will look crazy to the outside world. We will be a little bit dangerous to the outside world when we're in those stages. Nothing's working. We don't know what will break through in us. What they efforted to do was to create places that people in these crises could go to. Now, that still hasn't come into being as fully as they would like. But it's a need that we have, is that safe, protected place that holds us while we integrate this new level of something that's breaking through.
I'm in that space, but if I were to experience something like that on the other.
Don't call that individuation. I'm coming into who I am called to be. Now that's really the idea, that at the center of us is a self. We're born with this self, with all its potential, and almost like a blueprint of who we are to be. Now that's a certain theological view. We don't all have to agree with that. Certainly the ancient Hindu texts talk about the self, the Atman within. I mean, it's an archetypal idea. No. Say more about that. Say more about that.
Well, the sense of name, I'm just calling individuation.
Yeah. No. Why I even use that name is sometimes it helps us to have a name for what's happening. It binds up the raw energy of it. Even why we go back and look at some of these myths. No, we're not going to go back and, you know. But it gives us a name. I'm in my Medea right now. Okay, I know it's danger. I know a lot of what the images that gather around that energy. I don't have to go out there and do it. With treasured friends, I can say, hey, wait a minute. You know, just know Medea's up for me right now. But ultimately, what are we going to do with it? Maybe toward the last half hour today, we could bring focus to that. Of what do we walk out the door with? Maybe the last hour might take a little more time than that. Yeah. Kelly, are we in business? Anything you need? Yeah. All the way over to the side. Now is to complete our journey with Medea. And then once we're on the other side of her story, get a chance to really take a look at where we are and what questions this has raised for us. There's so many different little tentacles out here, so many different ways that we could go. So if there's anything that you really feel is important that we not neglect, bring it to my attention, because we've seeded a lot, and we may not get to it all, but we'll do the best we can. Again, if you'd like to do anything with your hands or with your feet, anything, just go ahead. Know that the materials are here, and it is a nice way to continue working with the myth. So just feel free to do that if that's good for you. Now, it seems like when we ended with Medea, Kelly had raised the point of how she had lost connection, if you will, with her goddesses. And we're just starting. We're just starting, so that's a good time. I'd like to pick up in an area close to this. Now here's Medea in a time of utter abandonment, rejection, betrayal, which catapults her into her psychic depths, deep into her interior, the realm of inner darkness and suffering, into the psychological realm of the archetypes. She's gone way down under now. When she reemerges, she is not filled with depression, self-pity, or paralysis, but a cry for revenge, for retribution, for blood. As she has been devastated within, she desires to create devastation without. in some ways, there's a yearning, you know, as above, so below, so within, so without. This very strong, destructive surgings now. She wants to create this without herself.
In that place, she has no doubt about
her. Oh, no. No.
I think all you really have no doubt is going to reach that feeling of your own.
Right, and that might
touch.
I mean, are you saying, Kate, like, I have been wrong, this is wrong? I say, this is no, I say no to this.
There is another psychological place where that it isn't clear.
Am I entitled to. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that. I'm not entitled to these. A good family. It's so, you know, this is one that so much focus right now is on, well, like Bradshaw's doing, where he's really getting us sensitive to the dysfunctional family and what that looks like. But it can be as difficult to have the good family. Because what is there to go off and push against? What is there that is giving us that restlessness within, that pain within, that prods us and nags at us? So it's got its own journey as to when it's so good, how do I individuate out of that? Well, that's where I see that some of these myths are very important for particularly good, nice people. I mean, you'll notice that I'm talking about some of the uglier myths. These are not the beautiful. We're not sitting here talking about the finer aspects of Aphrodite. We're talking about, you know, there's a lot of blood and gore and ugliness and beheading and all of this. And I think it's very much a companion to even a Christian ethic of being good and the light. A lot of our current New Age of being in the light. These darker aspects of the feminine complement them in a very rich and dynamic way. They contain a lot of blood energy. And if we have time today, I want to come back to this motif of blood energy, because it's in the Medusa for sure, and you're going to hear about it in the Medea as well. And again, if we have time, we'll go back and look at a couple of those Medusa images and talk about it linked to blood energy. Okay, let's kind of go forward. Well, we'll start dreaming the myth onward a little bit this morning. I want to share with you the Medea myth. I don't have slides of her. She's not an image that the Greeks put on their temples or put on as much of their funerary urns. There are a few. And back in about 84, when I got very taken with her, I went over to the Louvre in Paris and was stunned to see one image of her on this old urn, and there she was shown with her blade about to kill her children. And that's pretty much the memory we keep of her, of the killing mother. And that's a very forbidden aspect of motherhood for sure. And those of you who've had good mothers probably don't even know that a mother could ever have such a killing impulse. But a lot of us who've been mothers know that there have been times when we have wished for space for ourselves, and that feels forbidden, that feels like we're not being the good mother, that we're not being there the way we should be. So just with some of these aspects in mind, we'll listen to Medea. You know what I think might be best, while we're listening to her, is for you to just be as comfortable as you can be. If you want to take a break, let's take a couple of minutes break. Get coffee if you want some coffee or tea. I could say for everything that was said in this room is part of me also. And probably the dreaded feminine comes a lot in my own journey with who I am as a woman. I spent a good number of years in the Bay Area raising my daughters, and as Kate said last night, started a school for 9 to 14-year-olds. At the same time, I was in graduate school and studying psychology, but I was most interested in social psychology at the time. I was very, very concerned with social change and social action. And I didn't really believe in one-to-one therapy. And I went back to graduate school in the early 70s, and there was a time in Berkeley when there was a great deal of opposition to classical psychology, and particularly depth psychology. Freud was an anathema. And there was a lot of criticism of that kind of therapy that was many times a week at high cost, and it was seen as a social blight. You know, what was happening? So I was schooled somewhat in that tradition. Fritz Perls was down at Esalen, stirring everybody up. It was a hubbub of activity in Berkeley. So not only was I studying psychology at UC Berkeley, I was also creating a school for kids. It was an alternative school where how could young people at this pubertal interface, how could they stay in schools in a way that they stayed intact as whole people? And Berkeley at that time was a dynamic place for experimentation. And it wasn't just experimentation in kind of a libertine, laissez-faire way. It was really trying to be very conscientious about it. And I had two daughters that were invested in this, too. So I was concerned, what is it that we're doing? Now, meanwhile, as all of this is happening, I myself am being taken to places in myself I never planned to go. Roles were falling away. Things weren't working. I saw no mirrors back that told me what was happening to me. And I went into different kinds of therapies trying to understand what is it in me that is always breaking through, always breaking through. I was very involved in religion at the time, considered going to seminary, thought that that was going to be my path, went on many, many pilgrimages. In some ways you could say was a seeker. Maybe I'm still a seeker. But I find that now what I'm seeking is the depths of the psyche, perhaps. I think it's all ultimately one. The dreaded feminine came real close to me because of who I am as woman. There was a resonance. It was a resonance that kept saying there's something here for me. And my own, as I call them, crazy parts, made more sense to me. When I read the Medea many, many, many years ago, when I saw Dame Judith Anderson do Medea, I thought, why am I having this deep response to her? I am a good, loving wife and mother. And yet there is something about this woman that wants to kill her rival, wants to kill the children that come as a result of her union with Jason. I couldn't understand this place way down in here that was stirred. I'm still efforting to understand that deep, deep stirring that comes way down in the depth of our being. Medea means a lot to me. I now understand what she means for me a lot more. She led me to Medusa, and that was a harder one for me to come to terms with, Medusa, because that is real archetypal dangerous energy over there, because it's so it eliminates all images, and that's really scary for me. It was for me. I'm wandering around as to why I'm doing this, because I'm still wandering around doing it. And I'd say that what I'm trying to do now is to integrate the psychological and the spiritual. And I see that they interface somewhere here with the dreaded feminine. And as I'm working with, I mentioned last night, the Women's Spiritual Center, we've been looking at just what does this interface look like. I want to go to Medea now. Okay. I'm just going to read a little bit to you. Thanks. This is the Medea. And now, who was she? In the Medea, Euripides plunges his 5th century BC audience into the maelstrom of betrayed marital love. The grieving Medea calls upon the gods to witness what sort of return Jason has made to her love. And here I'm quoting Euripides. She lies without food and gives herself up to suffering, wasting away every moment of the day in tears. So it has gone since she knew herself slighted by him. But who is this disconsolate woman turned inward upon her pain? This is the Medea, legendary for her powers which enabled the Greek Jason to accomplish his heroic retrieval of the golden fleece from her father's land. As the drama unfolds, Medea will remind Jason, I saved your life, and every Greek knows I saved it. Every Greek who was a shipmate of yours aboard the Argo, when you were sent to control the bulls that breathed fire and yoke them, and you would sow that deadly field, also that snake who encircled with his many folds the golden fleece and guarded it and never slept, I killed and so gave you the safety of the light. And I myself betrayed my father and my home, and came with you to Peleus' land of Iolcus, and then, showing more willingness to help than wisdom, I killed him, Peleus, with a most dreadful death at his own daughter's hands, and I took away your fear. So this is Medea reminding Jason all that she's done for him. It was she who provided Jason with the magic potion which would protect him from the bull's fiery breath. It was she who instructed Jason to cast the stone among the advancing dragon teeth men. And again, it was Medea who drugged the snake protecting the golden fleece of the sacrificed ram. You'll get a sense of her powers and her abilities. For each of the hero's task, this is the woman of knowing who protects with the feminine arts of herbs and potions, magic spells and secret instructions, thereby enabling Jason to become one of the early Greek heroes. This is the Medea of the magic cauldron, that vessel of the feminine, which she used first to illustrate her powers to rejuvenate and later to destroy. Now, this is that motif of container, the cauldron. Last night we saw a container called a head. The head is like a container of consciousness, of awareness. And in our emphasis on enlightenment and the light, we've focused on the head and at times eliminated a lower cauldron, the cauldron, if you will, of the lower body. You will see in some of the Greek sculptures, early sculptures, in the feminine, the lower full hips, almost as if the lower part of the body itself is a container, itself is a vessel, itself is a cauldron. A blood cauldron, if you will. To rid Jason of his dreaded rival, Peleus, he who was going to be a contender for Jason's right to the kingdom, Medea comes up with this diabolical scheme. She says to, she pulls out her cauldron, and she shows that if she puts in an old ram, casts her spell over the cauldron, out comes a young kid. So in other words, she's able to restore to youth. So Peleus, the contender for the throne, he's an old man, and he wants to be young again. And she says, aha, okay, why don't you climb into my cauldron? And she gets his daughters to help. It's a rather gory story. They put in their father into Medea's cauldron, and she does her spell. Only this time, she doesn't restore him to youth. She kills him. The point being that in her cauldron, she carries both the power for creation, restoration, renewal, redemption, as well as death, destruction. And this is a very important aspect of the deep feminine, that these opposites come together into one space. And therein is their danger, their dread, what we fear, and yet what also carries some of our fascination in our awe. Jung calls this the miracle of Medea. He doesn't go on to explore a great deal. This is in his very first work that he writes. If you ever get a chance to look at all of the collected works, this is volume 5. That is the volume that marks his break from Freud, The Symbols of the Unconscious. He was taken with the very depths of the unconscious at that time and said there's more to it than just sexual symbolism, sexual energy. Remember, he was starting to say to Freud, there are spiritual stirrings in the psyche. There is a spiritual instinct in the psyche. There is a religious instinct in the psyche. And he's looking at these early myths with that in mind. Now, this is the Medea, her heart on fire with passionate love, says Euripides, who abandons her father and her homeland. Oh, my father, oh, my country, in what dishonor I left you, killing my own brother for it. This is Medea, the woman from the edge of the patriarchal world, the distant Asian land, inflamed with love for the heroic man from the land of rational culture. The price of this love is a complete uprooting of her being. She is called to leave all that gives her history and identity. Colchis, her homeland, lies on the eastern shore of the Black Sea. To the Greek perspective, this is a land barbaric, alien, and irrational. The sun rises over Colchis. It is over Greece that it reaches its zenith, Greece where the rational logos has ascended. So you can hear, if you be listening to this, you think both within ourselves as individuals and also collectively what has happened. This describes a process that we all seem to go through, that there comes a time where we separate from the personal mother, from the very depths of our being, where it's all one. As early children, we are allowed to be in the irrational. And part of ego consciousness is separating out of that realm and coming up into greater and greater ego awareness, more of what starts to make sense, more of sometimes what we call the rational. But we pay a price for this. We separate out from part of our being. It is through dreams, it is through what you now are doing of letting ourselves draw and paint and write, move, dance, that we try to stay connected to that world over there on the edge, that world of the rising sun. This is the Medea of personal sacrifice, who in casting from the stern of the fleeing Argo the dismembered body of her brother, cuts herself off from her blood ties and allegiances. She scatters her heritage into the depths of the sea, cruelly severing her blood ties and casting her lot with the patriarchal Greek heroic world. Paul, you were talking about meeting these 30 women, you know, these women that come at you with all of this stirring in them. And I think the Medea is a story for a lot of women who have, as young women, cast their lot perhaps with a man, married, started families, and merged their identity with the male world. And two of you this morning talked about the animus. And these women often will find themselves having something called the animus becoming very, very, almost part of their identity. Who is this that seems to so possess and rule me? In my own work with women, I've discovered that actually the issue is not so much the animus, but what lies behind the animus. That the animus indicates that we have severed our connection to the deep feminine. And that's partly our issue with him, is what are we going to do with him? Now, I think we as Jungians have not helped women on this regard. I think we have placed the animus into women. Very much as it's if you want to think psychologically, it's like the way the culture gets interjected, the way the culture comes inside of us. If we feel comfortable saying it's been a patriarchal time for many thousands of years now, and a lot of us feel more comfortable with that. We don't have to fight that anymore. That our Father God represents that for us, for all of us, for men and for women. And we've all are coming to a time where maybe we want to dream the myth a little bit further on. We take that introject in. That introject lives inside as the animus for a lot of us. How that culture lives inside of us. Now, there comes a point when we have to get around that and say, what are the other possibilities? And there are those who are very opposed to the Jungian perspective because of the animus theory, saying it's further oppressing women by saying you are animus identified or animus possessed. We won't get into that today, but I just acknowledge their work because I think it's important criticism. And there are some, like, you might have Verena Cast come one day and speak, and you'll hear her viewpoint is that we all, men and women, have an animus. Men and women, we all have an anima. And there's a lot of room for us to dialogue that way. Jung, if you remember, I mean, Jung in his time was describing things that he was discovering over there in Zurich that seemed to be linked to all cultures, but he also was a man of his time. Now I want to go on to the motif of what happens to Medea. She's left behind now. Last night I touched on this part of the myth. If you remember, Jason's come. He wants the golden fleece. There is the daughter of the king who knows how to get it for him. And she does everything she can. She really has fallen in love with this great hero. And she goes back with him to his land. And we pick her up now, 10 years later. After 10 years of marriage to Medea, Jason has decided to choose a new bride. As I said last night, he's in his midlife crisis. And it is the daughter of the king of Corinth. Euripides chooses to leave the princess bride unnamed, indicating her lack of character and identity, in sharp contrast to the powerful presence of Medea. So Euripides, back in the 5th century BC, is on to something already as to the power of the Medea, of what she represents. Jason says, "On my wedding with the princess, here I will prove that first, it was a clever move, secondly, a wise one, and finally, that I made it in your best interest and that of the children's. This was the main reason, that we might live well and not be short of anything." In his choice of a new bride, Jason speaks not of the heart and love, but of expedience, political advantage, and financial security. His is the Greek world of law, reason, heroic journeys from the dark, dangerous, chthonic realm. Jason chooses order, permanence, stability, security. An old wife has been replaced for practical, materialistic reasons, with no regard for this decision's effect in the relational sphere. Medea cries out, "Ah, lost in my sufferings, I wish I might die." When Medea recounts her investment in his heroic tasks, Jason depersonalizes and depreciates her by attributing everything to Aphrodite. For him, Aphrodite made him do it, not out of love for Medea. He says, "My view is that Aphrodite alone was responsible for men and for gods for the preserving of my life." He adds, "You have certainly got me more than you gave." No, excuse me. "You have certainly got from me more than you gave. First, instead of living among those barbarians, you inhabit a Greek island and understand our ways. You understand how to live with the law instead of the sweet will of force." Jason fails to understand Medea's reality or empathize with her role as wife and mother and her consequent suffering. Medea says, "I am deserted, a refugee, thought nothing of by my husband, something he won in a foreign land. I have no mother or brother, nor any relation with whom I can take refuge in this sea of woe." For a moment, can you get a sense of what the Medea is experiencing at this time? Are there any questions as to what's happening with her or for her right now? And we'll go on. Hers has not been a cool, partial, conditional love. She has given of her totality, and therein lies her vulnerability. With Jason's betrayal of his wedding vows, Medea is betrayed and deserted and thrust into an emotional exile. All that she has created, believed in, dedicated herself to, has fallen away. If you were to think about this as a personal journey out from the unconscious, and you think back in the beginning, for those of you in counseling and psychology will know that in the last 20 years, we've had a tremendous increase in interest in early childhood. And people like Margaret Mahler, who start to delineate those early stages, how we start with this sense of oneness, that we are identified with the mother. The mother and I are one. You could say it is as if we ourselves are in that cauldron where all the opposites come together. Everything that, last night, Neumann used that word, the uroboric mother. That place where everything is contained within itself. The world of the archetypes. The world of the self. Gradually, in development, all those little stages of separating out from the mother are critical ways the ego starts to be built up. How, in a way, we go to the Greek land of consciousness. We get this little bit of sense of how the world works. We start to try to make it predictable, to understand its laws, to understand its order, to understand its rules. We're also moving into the patriarchal sense of what law and order and rules are about. But that's what that little ego is doing. And then it goes back to the mother, and it fuses with her and merges with her, and then it goes out again. Now, people like Melanie Klein, those of you who know the work of Melanie Klein, who was an early post-Freudian. Are most of you familiar with Melanie? Do you know the name Melanie Klein? Those of you who don't, just raise your hands. I have a sense of... Melanie Klein was a very interesting Freudian who got taken with children. And she got seen through her work with adults that people were regressing to very early states, and that they were finding that they possessed in those early infantile stages things like affects like hate and rage and greed, and things that we don't attribute to the infant. You know, we project onto the infant innocence, purity, beginning out of the good. Melanie Klein dared to say that the infant carries within it the potential for destructive kinds of feelings, wanting to destroy the mother, wanting to hate the mother. Now, that's controversial. That's in how you see it. How is the object outside the self perceived? First, it's perceived in what they call a part object, the breast of the mother. They don't talk about the bottle, but they talk about the breast of the mother. But anyway, this is linked with those kinds of looking at early states. What's relevant for us in our own journey, as we go back to our beginnings, we often will discover that there are in the shadow, in the unconscious, forbidden impulses. It may come out even toward the good and perfect mother. And this is a very difficult thing to understand. How could I have these darker feelings? They may not come out toward the personal mother. It may come out toward your lover. That may be where you first see them. It may come out toward the sales clerk in the market. Very good point. Worse yet, it may come out toward yourself. And that's very often where you see it. And it's the skill of the therapist to help you pull that off yourself. Because in some ways, that's what keeps us down in the cauldron in its worst way, where we are torn between the creative and the destructive aspects and can't get any good out of it. And when we're in there, in that maelstrom of all those feelings and all those forbidden impulses and energies, we need some help to differentiate them, pull them apart, take a look, and attribute them to other places than to the self. Making sense? Depression, certain kinds of depression particularly carry this, where the person gets locked down in there, can't get out, and there is this hateful, hateful attack on the self. I am totally worthless. I'm not worth being here. Some people can get very dangerous to themselves and in one of those mad moments act out a destructive impulse. It's a very powerful state. And as you hear these dreaded feminine images, you can imagine that if you are down there in them and you don't have any sense of myth or any sense of images or names, you could just swirl around in that. Yeah. Say that again, take connection to...
Connection.
Yeah. There is no connection. There's no container. There's no connection. There's no relatedness. And relatedness becomes essential in this space. And very often when we're in the depths of it, you'll notice, those of you who've gone there, how you wish for someone to reach through to you, to somehow be there for you and understand or say something, do something, maybe just be there, just so that there's some sense of container, but also relatedness. The very missing is, and you'll hear this with Medea. I mean, what's happening, she's getting terribly unrelated. She's cut off ties with the only world, in the world that she's come from. She's lost connection with her beginnings. As I said last night, she had a very poor connection to her mother, mythically. We know very little about her, except in Euripides we're given a name that etymologically means she who knows. But Medea's cast off from that woman, and she becomes identified just as the father's daughter, the king's daughter. And then in her journey to the Greek world, she severs her connections to her father, and she kills her brother. She chews him up into little pieces and casts him off the back of the boat so that the father will get distracted and rescue the son, his son, so she can help Jason to get away. I mean, she's severing all ties to her beginnings. Yes, Kelly.
Medea was connected with the goddess Hecate, who is goddess of the night, the dread of the night. I wonder, when she was removed from culture, was she also lost in her duty to the mother and her husband to the worship of the moon goddess Hecate, who is also like a Hermes character at the cornerstone of Crossroads.
Crossroads, yep. Great. And like last night, when you quickly move to redemption with the Pegasus, you are anticipating exactly where we're going. That's great. You can feel the move. That's exactly where it's got to come.
And I was just thinking myself, in noting as you were taking us through the myth, that I guess I've had, you know, also the necessity to go to the order and the stability, which a lot of the times identify get it, then I get it, which I think I'm bound for.
Good.
And therefore, in the status of having no longer voted again for all of the colleagues to be in the community and the structure, longer than it was up to be to the in that region and that body, but I'm not forgotten, or I am no longer in the relationship where I forgot self.
Right, right. Kelly raises some good points about grief and sadness. As you'll notice in the story of Medea, we're going to talk more about rage. And those of you who have encountered rage, particularly feminine rage, it is an awesome, terrifying experience, whether it comes at us or from within us. Often behind that rage, way back behind that, is a profound and desperate grief. And I don't think it's an accident that the Lamentations used to be feminine. And on tombs, ancient tombs, you would see the Lamentations in weeping, that they were on that threshold of the death realm. And we in our time have forgotten that, of the importance of lamenting and grieving and allowing the shedding of tears. You didn't hear anything having to do with tears with Medusa, and you don't hear them with the Medea. And yet that's way back there, is the grieving of what's been lost. And before Medea leaves Colchis, she does have a night of prayer. We'll hear a little more about it as you hear the goddesses that she draws on. Draws on. Now, they go with her, but we don't yet know what that's going to look like. Any other questions right now? Thanks, Kelly. That was a good point. Any other questions, Paul?
Yeah, there's one point you made about coming out of the depression, sort of reaching out and recovering the depression. But aren't there two ways that an individual does it? One, by reaching out in a positive way, and the other, by dumping the shame-based material on somebody else so that it goes on in a multi-generational situation.
You should. Very much so. So that that person, in their own... Right. Because of what has been cast over into them. Is that what you're... Right? That originally, this person trying to get rid of this thing, as you said, their shame-basedness, passes it on to the next. Right. What... within a family particularly. And there's a model... Yes. It really depends how it's been done. And it reminds me of something Jung suggests. He says in a letter... complexes start 100 years before. Now, we don't have to get attached to the number 100, but what he's suggesting is they go on from generation to generation. So, the mother, the father, whatever, passes it on. But does she get rid of it? I want to show you it. A drawing of something, or a sketch of something. Kate will identify this. This is an important concept of what the relationship between two people looks like. Here's number one. This is the first person, and this is the second person. And they're in relationship. Jill, you and I are in relationship. Here we are, thinking we're being conscious. Jill's sitting over there, and she's in relationship to her unconscious. Pooh's over here. I'm in relationship.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.